Good afternoon, this is Darcy Killeen with the UW Archives Oral History Project. I'm sitting here in the Red Gym with Mary Rouse during an interview conducted by Emily Min. So go ahead, Emily.
Okay. The date is February 23rd, 2001. And I'm going to start with a question. Could you describe your vision as Dean of Students for Student Services?
Yes, and this is a while ago, so bear with me. I began a career in student services in 1967 here as an admissions counselor. And so I had lots of experiences with students in lots of different ways, beginning in admissions. Subsequently, I became an assistant dean in 1973 and was an assistant dean until September 1st, 1987, when I became the Dean of Students. Now, the real question is, why did I decide to apply for the dean's position? It certainly wasn't because I wanted to get bashed as a public official or make more money or have a big fat title. I applied for the job because fundamentally I am absolutely crazy about our students. And I believed that there were lots of weaknesses in terms of how we were treating undergraduates in particular. I don't want to exclude graduate students, but certainly my focus particularly was on undergraduate students. We had no enrollment management plan. Many freshmen couldn't get access to the classes that they wanted. Freshmen couldn't register at a very weak summer orientation program. I just didn't feel that we were treating and respecting students as we should. And you know, my belief is that students here are among the smartest, most talented people in the world, and also that they are producers instead of consumers. And I wanted to enter into a partnership with students that was based on mutual respect. Once in a while somebody would suggest to me that I was the mother to the students. I never ever have seen myself in that role. I've seen myself in a true partnership. So I thought in the spring of 1987, well, there are some things that I would like to get done, and I don't know whether I'd even have a chance at the job, but I guess I'll throw my hat into the ring and see what happens. And really, to my great surprise, I was offered the position at the end of the summer then and started, as I said, September 1st. However, there was a watershed event that occurred in June of 87, and that was the selection of Donna Shalala as our next chancellor. And what was watershed about that was that I knew enough about her to know that she was really crazy about students. And also, I knew that the Board of Regents had given her a mandate to strengthen and improve undergraduate education. And I'm not sure if Donna had not been selected as chancellor whether I would have accepted the position, because I wanted to work for a chancellor whose views were obviously in alignment with my own, a chancellor that would focus on students, particularly freshmen. Freshmen are shy and they're scared and they're introverted, and they need someone reaching a very warm handout and helping them get connected. 20% of our students are new to the campus every year. So when I wrote my letter of application in May of 87, it was with an articulated agenda, and the center was students. The second part of that agenda was strengthening and improving student services or student affairs. Morale was very poor at that time. Many of the student services were in very crummy space. No one knew where to find a lot of the student services offices. Student services folks a lot of them consider themselves to be down in the basement with the mushrooms in terms of their standing on the campus. So I really had two major agenda items. One, and the most important always for me, is students, and what can we do to serve our students better, to get them to connected, to make them into producers, as I said. And secondly, to try to restore or improve the morale and the standing of our many, many talented student affairs staff around the campus. So that was my vision. There are lots of particulars to that vision, but that's the overall vision.
You've touched on this a little bit, but I would say, what changes to the existing programs were the key to your vision?
Well, I would say the first part was freshman orientation, mm-hmm. was strengthening and improving freshman orientation. And by August of 1988, I opened the student orientation program. Again, Donna Shalala was the first chancellor we could ever even get over to an orientation program, and she immediately agreed that we needed to put more resources into it and strengthen it. So I would say that that was key. Another thread that has run through my whole life has to do with human rights, and I also, at that same time, opened the Multicultural Student Center as a frontline program to recruit and retain our ethnic minority students, and also to make all kinds of connections with, obviously, majority students. Also done a lot of work with the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community. So human rights, and again, that respect for everyone on the campus, a safe campus climate. I've done a lot of work in safety and security. So those were the kinds of programs that we got started, you know, right away.
What university policies were working well at the time, and why?
Well, I would say that most university policies, if you're talking about the very big question of how the university operates, you know, the university's operated very, very well for a very long time. And, you know, in my mind, you know, we're talking about, you know, one area, albeit, you know, a pretty big area, but, you know, I certainly wouldn't find fault or offer criticism of, you know, the university at large. I mean, it's a faculty-governed institution, you know, again, smart, talented people doing all kinds of creative things, and mostly you need to turn them loose and let them do their work.
How did the decentralization of student services that you had mentioned before affect the quality of the university experience for students?
Well, I go back to, you know, first of all, you know, your shy freshman who has no idea where the Office of Student Financial Services is, or what the Multicultural Center is, or any of these places, these really great services. And so I knew that, and at the same time, I knew that we had to find a way to acknowledge student affairs, student services, acknowledge and highlight them so that students could get connected. And, you know, part of that is an oral problem. That is, if a freshman hears from a sophomore, oh, go to the financial services office, that will work well for you, then that freshman will go. But another part of it is the physical facilities. And clearly, at that time, for instance, the admissions office, undergraduate admissions, was located in two different buildings on five or six different floors. The transfer division was separated from the freshman division. The counseling center had eight full-time equivalent counselors. That's eight people for, 40,000 students. We had something like one counselor for every 6,200 students. So the services themselves were inadequately staffed. The locations were remote and fractured and disconnected. And then, of course, you know, the students, how do you let students know and how do you get them to make these connections? So there are a lot of issues. And don't forget the one that I mentioned earlier, which was we had no enrollment management. We let as many freshmen come as wanted to come. Essentially, it was the fire marshal who controlled, you know, how many students could be in a given class, and that's why so many freshmen in the late 80s and even into the early 90s, till we really got things organized and changed, were so frustrated. So a whole bunch of work that really needed to be done, and I felt was pretty urgent.
Wow.
Those are just some examples.
Wow. What were your initial concerns regarding the Red Gym?
Well, I didn't have any concerns about the Red Gym other than it was deteriorating very badly, and that was painful for me to watch. Remember, I came here at the end of 1967, and I just watched things worsen and worsen. Probably the most dramatic was the firebombing that occurred on January 2nd, 1970. So I watched the building deteriorate, and at the same time, knowing that we needed to both highlight student services to students and also find better digs for the student affairs folks, I cast my eye pretty quickly on the Red Gym as a very centrally located building, one with distinctive architecture, a building that was the center of student activities for the first 40 or 50 years of its life. And I thought, well, maybe there's a possibility that we could capture this space and adaptively use it and make it into our front door for student services, understanding that we could never place all the student services in one building. And early on in the project, Rose Barillette out at Facilities Planning and Management came upon the idea of a student services corridor so that all the frontline high traffic student services would be located within a 2-block radius. And that has come to pass with one exception. We are waiting anxiously for the new health services shared facility with student activities, with student government, which will likely be located on the corner of Lake and University Avenue, or right next to the extension building. There's a footprint there. And we hope that building will be online by 2005 or 2006 at the latest. And then again, that student services corridor would become absolutely complete.
Mm-hmm. Why did you accept Chancellor Donna Shalala's appointment to the head of the Committee of the Future Use of the Red Gym?
Well, you know, she and I, actually, we had met face-to-face in September of 87. She didn't hire me. Bernie Cohen was the acting chancellor at the time, and he hired me. But Donna and I had talked a couple times on the phone, and then she came out for lots of meetings in September. Remember, she started in January of 88. And we had a long meeting in my office. In fact, this is sort of funny. I wanted to get her a gift, and I went down to one of the bookstores, and I found a little pin that says, short people are more down to earth. Anyway, we had a great meeting. We liked each other immediately, and again, our goals were so similar, you know, and I could tell that, you know, this was going to be a really good partnership. And so we had talked about the space issues, obviously about the student issues, and we had actually gone on a tour of this building. She'd gone on space tours all over the campus, and she knew that we needed tremendous resources to be poured into our capital program. I mean, many of our buildings were in bad shape. We needed new buildings. And so this was one building that, you know, both she and I could see was hardly being used. We were lucky if we get 100 people in here a day, as compared with the Memorial Union that has around 18,000 people a day. So, you know, we began to talk about this, and she said, well, how about if we set up a committee that looks at the future use of the gym? And I said, great. At that time, you may know already that the building was assigned to recreational sports, Division of Recreational Sports, but it had long outlived its usefulness as any kind of modern recreational sports facility. And obviously many sports facilities had been built in the meantime. And so she asked me if I would chair this committee, and I thought, great, this is just great. And so we got a number of people, including the director of recreational sports, to sit on this committee, some students, some faculty members, and then started our work.
How did this project connect with your interest in student services?
Well, I want to answer another question that you didn't ask. my background, I should have said this earlier on, my academic background is Latin and Greek. And so I have a bachelor's degree in classics and a master's degree in ancient Greek language mm-hmm. and literature. Never got a job in that area. I got a job instead in student services. So I have a tremendous appreciation for the braid of history, and for buildings, and for continuity, and for historic preservation. And so then, obviously, you know, my professional life has all been in student services, and it seemed to me that, you know, we could combine historic preservation and adaptive use. You know, we're alive now. You can't preserve something for history unless you can figure out a suitable adaptive use. So it seemed to me that it might work, and I did do some work, I think actually through archives. There had been a few proposals for the adaptive use of this building, but they had never gone anywhere. And in fact, as you know, this building was almost torn down three times in this century. So the adaptive use that we proposed was the first use to really begin to resonate with people. And remember, it resonated with only a very small number of people initially. It took a lot longer to get it to resonate further out. But it just seemed to me that we had this opportunity. I mean, probably one of the finest pieces of real estate, you know, in the state of Wisconsin, you know, right on the lake, centrally located, unmistakable identity. Here you've got this situation with students who have, you know, great difficulty finding their way around. You know, told us over and over again, it's a great university, but, you know, I don't know how to get connected. And so that was really, those were really the underpinnings, mm-hmm. and certainly heavily supported by our chancellor.
Excellent. Could you talk a little bit about the workings of the Committee of the Future Use of the Red Gym? Their strengths, weaknesses, who are the key players?
I think everybody on the committee, actually, everybody was excellent. I give great credit to Roger Howard, our associate dean of students. He was the one that actually drafted the language in terms of the future use of the building. Rose Barillet was absolutely superb, always is, always has been. Bruce Murray, faculty member in landscape architecture, was certainly instrumental. The student members were very good. You know, it was a really solid committee. Dave Berge, the head of recreational sports, could see that he really needed to give the building up to you know, some other use, and you know, he's got plenty of recreational facilities himself. And so it was a good group of people, and the way we really started was drafting a vision that gateway statement, that front door statement that is in all the records. And then, you know, we concluded what we had already known, but that, you know, there were tremendous space shortages in student services. So then we decided that it would be good to write to everybody in student services and ask them if they would be interested in having space in the Red Gym. And so we had a whole bunch of hearings. We had space surveys that Rose Berlet and others out of facilities planning helped us with. So we went about this very systematically and determined, you know, which student services would be in the building. And this was almost a miracle. As it turned out, there were not more people that wanted to be in the building than we had space. Now, initially, we thought we were going to pull more space out of the building. Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot a very important person. Chris Gleasing was our university architect at the time, and he was just fabulous, absolutely fabulous key. But anyway, initially we thought we could pull out more space than it turned out that we could. And we, again, then, you know, began to talk about this corridor idea. And I think that helped a lot because people realized that not every student service could be crammed in any one building, that we would have to work with this, you know, more flexible two-block radius. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think you did. after the committee pretty much took care of what Shalala had asked for, what was the next step after that to making the Red Gym, starting the process?
Well, the next step was to try to get some planning money, to try to get a marker in the budget. And this is very complex, and I'll try to make this short, but first of all, you have to go to campus planning. That's our Madison campus committee. And you have to argue your case there. And remember that everyone on that committee has an idea of what the highest space needs are. So you've got to do your homework there. And if you do get through the campus planning committee, you've then got to go to the University of Wisconsin system planning, and you've got to get a marker there in the system budget. And of course, these are all the campuses competing for a relatively small amount of money. The capital budget at that time was very modest. We could look it up, but for the whole system, you know, it was I don't know, $50 million or something like that. Not very much at all. And if you get a marker there, then you have to get approved by the Board of Regents. But you also have to deal with a whole nother mid-level state bureaucracy, the Division of Facilities Development downtown, and they are staffed to the State Building Commission. And if you get through there, then you've got to get approval from the State Building Commission, chaired by the governor himself, and then ultimately the legislature has to approve. So we started down this road with the campus planning committee, and again, the records show it was a very arduous road, and we ended up going through that process, I think, either three or four complete times. Again, we can look up in the record. But from the outset, I would say that most people thought this project would never fly, would never, never fly. There were people, a few people who were using this building, like people who practiced judo here and karate, and then the gymnastics folks were on the second floor. They had just moved in overnight. They'd never even gotten permission. So there were a few people that were really angry at, you know, at the possibility of any change in the building. But most people just didn't think that, you know, the project would ever work, you know. But there were a few of us there was kind of a grassroots feeling about this project from the beginning, and I want to give great credit to our students who wanted to see this project go. Every student government, regardless of their political leanings, going back to 88, supported this project and could see that it would benefit them. They were the clairvoyants in the picture. So anyway, I don't know how to make this sum this up other than to say that every single step of the way, I had tremendous advice from lots of people like Chris Gleasing and Rose Barillat. We had a couple of faculty members on the campus planning committee. Larry Kahn, K-A-H-A-N, is one of them. He's a biomolecular chemist. He could see from the beginning that this was a really good, sound project. And, you know, we just did our homework. And actually, I want to give great credit to someone in DFD, and that's Charlie Qualiana, who's now with Isthmus Architects. Charlie is a great advocate of historic preservation. And even though DFD opposed the project, I believe that Charlie was one of the insiders that really helped us. And Charlie's the one who taught me about this wonderful architectural protocol called an historic structure report, and advised us that on the front end, if we could get that report done, that it would probably help us move the project forward. No HSR had ever been done on any public building in the state of Wisconsin. So we were able to get $200,000. Some of it we had to take out of actually other university resources, but we were able to essentially get that front end piece, the historic structures report, budget through. And again, still I don't think people thought that the project was going to go anywhere, but we got our oar in the water, so to speak. And so Charlie was really instrumental. I lost track of where I'm going. I'm sorry.
Well, we can back up and say, how did you get the project initially through the university? How did you gain the support of the Planning Commission, and then the system, and then the regions?
Well, with a lot of spit and a lot of passion, I guess I would say, Chris Gleasing had some lovely artist renderings done of how the building, you know, could look. We did our homework. We did presentations, I think very solid presentations. In fact, I think Larry Kahn would tell you that we made one of the best presentations to campus planning that he had seen in his tenure on the committee of several years. You know, we did our homework. And again, the larger framework, of course, was, you know, Chancellor Shalala and that mandate from the regents. So even though it was very hard, and lots of times, you know, we would pull it out by one vote, or you know, we'd have to engage in some letter writing campaigns or phone calling. But you know, I believed, and I still believe that this building is a very important historic landmark. That's another piece of this that we can talk about, how we went after National Historic Landmark status. So we just kept doing our homework and just kept relying on advice from that hardcore of people who really believed in the project. And we just kept moving. We just kept on moving. And I just, you know, the idea of seeing this building torn down was very, always very disturbing to me. And you know, you've probably heard me say this, Emily, this ain't the Boston Library, you know, but it's a unique building, virtually most armories having been torn down by now. So we just kept right at it. And I used up a lot of my political and professional chits, or whatever you want to call it, that I had built up over a long period of time. And I think, you know, eventually people figured I was just an unstoppable force.
So you were saying you used up a lot of your political favors there.
I used up a lot of favors. I called on every person that I could think of that could give us some help. The Alumni Association was with this project from the beginning. They were very helpful. We also met with everybody in this neighborhood, the State Historical Society, the library, the Wisconsin Union, at that time the Wisconsin Center, now the Pyle Center, the Alumni Association that I mentioned, and you know, outlined this project very early on. All the people in the neighborhood were very supportive of it, and that paid off well for us a little bit later on. But I, you know, I do want to make an important point, and that is historic preservation and adaptive use were our twin goals, and I have to say, I do not know how this building will be used 200 years from now, or, you know, even 100 years from now. I think that we have found a very appropriate adaptive use for now. The most important, or the more important, I should say, the more important part of this project to me was seeing that the building was preserved. And I don't think there's any way now that anyone could take this building down, given the National Historic Landmark status, you know, et cetera. So I just wanted to make that point on the record. I mean, I hope it'll always be used by students on one level, but I do understand that adaptive use concept well. Oh, I wanted to mention one more thing, too. We also, a lot of people were concerned about, well, you're gonna destroy this building. And again, very early on, we began to talk about the principle of historic reversibility, that we would not do anything to the building that would be so intrusive that it could not be put back the way it was at some former time in its life. Now, I mentioned, you may think I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, but initially there was an artist rendering of, you know, adding a floor, but that very quickly got dropped out of the project. The historic structure report was really significant, informative, and tremendously helpful. In fact, the historic structure report told us on the front end exactly what we would be getting into. So, you know, there weren't any big surprises, you know, once the project got rolling.
How did you use that historic structures report then later in the process for fundraising or as a lobbying tool?
Well, we taught people what an historic structures report is, and since that first one was done on the gym, there have been many more, which is just great. And we used the research, you know, from the archives, and you know, we drew out many pieces from that report and talked about them, just talked about them and talked about them. And, you know, a historic structure report is not simply the architecture and the fabric and condition of the building, it's the people, it's, you know, how the building was used, and then, you know, an evaluation of the proposed adaptive use. Now, the firm that did the HSR is Jack Waite out of Albany, New York, and they are very conservative, as you will find if you get into this material. And they had initially wanted us to keep the second floor pretty much as it was, as a basketball court or as an open space. And we convinced them that, you know, the space needs were so pressing that we simply, you know, couldn't do that. But the HSR was enormously helpful. I remember once meeting with Senator Brian Rood. He's no longer senator. He's a who is a history major here, and talking to him about the HSR and how fascinated he was to know that we had done this. So a very, very useful tool. Would recommend it to anybody.
You mentioned that you had to work a little bit with the State Historical Society. Mm-hmm. Can you go into that a little bit more?
We worked with Jeff Dean, particularly, at the State Historical Society, and they were not, although they were in the neighborhood and worked with us, they were less than enthusiastic about the project and very, very worried about any alteration to the fabric of the building. Eventually, they came around and helped us a great deal with the National Historic Landmark and so forth. So they were, interested, obviously, from a historical point of view, but I don't think could see the adaptive use possibility for quite a while. And maybe you'll interview Jeff Dean and he'll tell you that.
He's hanging out down in Arizona, so I have to track him down. Mm-hmm. What was the attitude of the State Division of Facilities Management, you said?
Their attitude was they thought this was a bad project and they wanted it to go away. And Bob Brandherm, who just retired as the head of DFD, was never, never on board with this project. Mm-hmm. And, from their point of view, they're trying to save money. They're trying to save the state money. And so I want to be fair about this. When they think of universities, they think of classrooms, libraries, laboratories, faculty offices. They're not thinking student services, summer orientation, counseling, multicultural center, and I don't even think that they really had their minds around, student services in the sense that student services would be as important, as a laboratory or a library, and so they were very difficult. Except I do believe I never talked to him directly about this, but I believe that Charlie Qualiana was a key insider who mm-hmm. did advocate for the project.
Mm-hmm. How did facilities management change the direction of the project?
They didn't really change it, except that they just kept telling me I had to raise more money. initially, this is a state-owned property, and initially it was supposed to be a GPR, general purpose revenue project, entirely funded by your tax dollar and mine. And so the way that they chose to try to kill the project was to put in a match of private money, and they just kept raising that bar. Initially it was it was paying for part of the historic structures report. And by the time we got all finished, I raised $7.25 million for the project in private dollars, and only $5.5 million, which is, I don't say only, but $5.5 million came from state GPR funds, from state taxpayers. So they thought that they could kill it by imposing these incredible private fundraising sums of money, and also they did not believe that we could raise any money for this building, and we just did.
What was the State Building Commission was your final hurdle in a sense. What was their attitude?
Oh, their attitude was terrible. Their attitude was absolutely terrible. And including a person from, I think he's from the Waukesha area, Bryce Stiza, who was just adamantly opposed to the project. The governor wanted it to go away. Again, we barely squeaked through the commission, And we did, thanks to people like Senator Fred Risser, who was really instrumental, longtime member of the commission, liked the building. This is a kind of an interesting thing. People either seem to like this building or hate the building. I mean, I don't know where they are now. I think most people actually like the building since we got it fixed up. But there seem to be sort of two camps. And Senator Risser always liked this building a lot, mm-hmm. and he was a real champion. And then there were, I'd have to go back and look at the names, but there were several other people on the State Building Commission that, again, could see the value of the project. You know, we did our homework, we talked to everybody, we made presentations, and I think the fact that the Multicultural Center was going to be located here was key with one or two members of the Building Commission that thought that was an important program, kind of what we wanted to do to create the front door. But we just barely squeaked through every single time.
How did the project, you talked a little bit about some of the construction and the attitudes of the different preservationists who were involved. How did that project change throughout the construction phase? And the ideas about how the space would be used?
Well, certainly the space as we originally configured it, after that we had all those hearings and everybody told us who wanted to be here, it changed. It didn't change dramatically. The most dramatic change actually was probably the mortgage center mm-hmm. here. Once we knew that the mortgages wanted to give two gifts, or presented to them, asked them for two gifts for the bricks and mortar for the gym, and then to expand our public service mm-hmm. efforts and to locate a program, which obviously they eventually gave us permission to use their name. So I would say the mortgage center was not planned to be here originally, and also what is now visitor services through the Chancellor's office. Those are really the two new programs. Mm-hmm. There were lots of arguments among the architects, the historic preservation architects, the State Historical Society, the folks downtown, for instance. There's a big fight about the brick on the outside and, you know, what would be used to clean the brick. Should it be lemon juice and water, or should it be some kind of, you know, acid, and, you know, where does air pollution come in here? And, you know, there were huge arguments, most of which I just stayed out of because I don't have the background to be able to weigh mm-hmm. in. But, you know, I wouldn't say there were horrible fights or anything. You know, basically, the project is pretty much the same as we conceived of it in 88 and 89.
How did funding shape the project?
Well, once we got our lead gift from the mortgages, huge lead gift, and the mortgages wrote to the governor at least once or twice, and as did lots of other people. I mean, once you've got, you know, show me the money. Once you've got the money, you're more than halfway home.
How did the university support the project financially?
How did the university support the project? Well, the university, that is the Madison campus, advocated for this project with system and people like John Torfey and, you know, obviously former Chancellor Shalala, former Chancellor Ward. You know, they were very solidly behind the project mm-hmm. and really enormously helpful with the politics. David Ward called this building a slum and said, you know, it needs to be fixed up, you know. and they were very, you know, we haven't talked very much about the National Historic Landmark designation, but that's a very big deal, as you know, and you don't easily get your building or buildings designated as NHLs. And I remember when we decided we were going to go for National Historic Landmark status for this building, then I thought, why not Science Hall too? And went to see Chancellor Ward, who was the provost at the time, and he was, you know, very supportive of our putting in designations for both of them. And then, of course, we went out and found the smartest person maybe in the Midwest to write those nominations. And that helped us, again, you know, enormously. We were able to get some Getty money for some of the conservation, brick conservation issues, that is in Getty oil money, mm-hmm. Getty historic preservation money. You can't even walk through the door of the Getty Foundation unless you have NHL designation. So see, I learned all these things from lots of smart, talented people and you know, reading that I did, you know, on my own. And I guess, you know, most of all, we did our homework initially, a small core of us, and we just kept right at it.
Let's see. Could you talk a little bit more about the donations from the mortgages and how that led to other funding from other private donors?
Sure. In May of 1994, I flew out to visit the mortgages and stay as their house guest for the weekend, along with Don Gray from the UW Foundation, who is one of the champions, one of the people who believed in this project from the outset. And I was invited to go out there to present two projects. As I said, one was the bricks and mortar for the gym itself, for the historic preservation, etc., and the other was to expand our public service initiatives at the university. And so I had never met the mortgages, and I was carrying not only the Red Gym plans and some artist renderings, but we had just put out a beautiful booklet, a very slick booklet for fundraising. And also in terms of the mortgage, what's now the Mortgage Center, Gary Sandifer, now our acting provost, and a number of us had put together a plan for how we would like to see public service expanded at Wisconsin, a long tradition of public service, but we knew there was lots more to be done. So Don and I went out to breakfast with the mortgages, and I presented both proposals. Don had sat with me the night before, gone over the presentation, told me everything to do. He knows the mortgages, and he's our principal link or steward with the mortgages. And so I went to breakfast, was, you know, obviously very nervous. Their company, Cisco, their stock had dropped 17 points that morning.
Ooh.
And anyway, I met with them, and then, as I said, I'd been invited to stay for the weekend, and Don told me not to say another word to them about these proposals that I'd made throughout the weekend. I did, you know, everything he told me to do. I didn't hear anything. That was May, it was like about the 20th of May, and in the middle of August, I got an email from John Morgridge, who said, Tasha and I, and they always make their decisions together, have decided that we're going to support both these proposals. They're very good proposals. We like them. We believe that you can pull us off. And so I was ecstatic. And when they gave us the stock, they gave us 100,000 shares of stock, which initially was worth about $33 a share, but it went up to about $100 a share. And so our money was just, it was just incredible. And of course, I never even had a garage sale. Fortunately, I was not managing the money. The foundation was managing the money, but they sold it at all the opportune times. So what started as a much more modest sum of money, maybe about a $1 million and $1 million gift, very quickly became several millions. I can't even remember. These numbers were so big. And that visit in May was the beginning of a wonderful, wonderful relationship, friendship that I have with John and Tasha Morbridge. And I have to tell you this for the record, no one will believe this, but I only asked them for that one gift, or those two initial gifts. I never asked them for any money. Don Gray felt that I was a little bit short on the historic preservation side, so he asked them for an additional $600,000, which they gave me, which was terrific. And then last May, when I was out there, they had initially challenged me to, we need $6 million in endowment for the Morbridge Center, for the operating budget. And so we have about $4 million, and they then challenged me to raise $2 million to round out the endowment from like businesses and corporations. And when I walked into the house, literally, my husband was there as my witness. Tasha was there, there were only the three of us, and she said, I'm glad no one else is here yet, because John and I talked this over last night, and we've decided that raising money isn't the highest and best use of your time, and therefore we're giving you the $2 million to complete the endowment for the Morbridge Center.
Wow.
And I just couldn't believe it, but believe you me, I never asked for mm-hmm. gift two or gift three, but and they have been very happy with the way the renovation and adaptive use has gone, and with the development, the expansion of the Morbridge Center. I mean, I think these are donors that give generously to many, many programs, lest you think they're only giving me. But once we got that lead gift, and it then became much easier to get, you know, other gifts, although, you know, we didn't get any gift of that magnitude. We got lots of gifts of, you know, 50,000, 10,000, 25,000 gifts matched with corporations, classes, graduating classes, donating money. But money, a lead gift means that somebody with a lot of money has confidence that things are going to work, and then it, you know, it attracts, you know, other gifts.
Excellent. How did you stay motivated? This was a really long project. How did you stay interested?
Well, you know, all I can tell you is that some part of me, and you know, I believed that this was a good project, and that it would benefit, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of students. One thing that I haven't talked about yet is I want our recruiting of smart, brainy, talented students to be as strong as the athletic department's recruitment of student athletes. And I feel so strongly about that. However superficial first impressions may be, first impressions are very important, and I wanted to be able to say to every prospective student, look, you know, we really have an incredible university here. It is a world-class institution, and let's introduce you to it, and then hopefully get you to apply and to come here. So that's very, very important to me. And I was just so disgusted with the undergraduate admissions facilities that I've mentioned. I mean, it's just terrible to, you know, try to bring in, you know, somebody who's young and full of vitality mm-hmm. and excited, and, you know, run them around to all these different places. And so I felt the whole visitors piece, we're one of the only universities in the country of our size that had no visitors operation. But then beyond that, what I could see, since I studied all the early history, was, you know, how many students had used this building and identified with this building, you know, so strongly. And I wanted to give them a sense of place. So you come as a prospective student, you come back for summer orientation, then you come back and you use many of the programs, you know, throughout the building. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had this idea in my mind, and, you know, did I get discouraged, and did I get frustrated, and did I wake up in the night many times and wonder if I'd lost my mind, and was this really going to work? The answer is absolutely yes. I really often wondered, you know, because I, you know, the Southern expression is a person only has so much spit, and you have to decide where you want to use your spit. I used an enormous amount of my spit on this building, and I just kept thinking that it was the right thing to do, and if I just stayed with it, that it would work.
Mm-hmm. What were the most difficult arguments that were put forward by opponents of this project?
Well, I suppose the most difficult arguments were, you know, it's not really of any historic value. It's a big old barn. It's, you know, brick, glass, and metal. It's not the highest and best use of university funds, or anybody's funds for that matter, for this particular adaptive use. You're going to destroy the building. It won't be the same as it was for the, you know, particularly some of the old timers. Mm-hmm. I guess those were the most difficult. And then, you know, just wending your way through all these political landmines, you know, and being taken by surprise. I mean, right toward the end, I don't know what the date was, but, you know, there was suddenly this strange, and I mean strange, proposal that came out of DFD to essentially cancel the project and keep only two programs here, place two programs here, international students and the Multicultural Center. The rest of it they would give to the Wisconsin Center at that time, and they would cut a hole through the wall, and this could be a distance education facility, and then they could do some archival storage with the State Historical Society. I mean, it was the craziest proposal, and it just came out of left field, and I had no warning about it, you know, until the day it, you know, was announced, and I'm just like, how could anybody do this? What mind could think up this kind of adaptive use for this building? This building belongs to students. And it was bizarre. And I never even called the governor's office. I never even asked anybody to call the governor's office. But by that time, I think about 500 people called the governor's office that morning. People were angry. People had, you know, heard me talk and knew that this was for students, about students, that it fit in with trying to strengthen and improve that climate for undergraduate students, and they were hopping mad, and they called, and that proposal got buried deep. In fact, I haven't even, have you found it yet in the?
Oh yeah.
You found the actual, that's just about accurate, isn't it?
Yeah.
What they were gonna,
yeah.
Oh, the other thing was, I wanted to spin this out real quickly. I mentioned that we had really good relationships, cultivated relationships with everybody in the neighborhood. So the morning I saw that proposal, that Nick Mueller, I think, was the head of State Historical Society at the time, mm-hmm. and I had, you know, worked with him, and then I knew the head of Extension, which involves the Wisconsin Center, now Pyle Center, and I knew right away that they had not approved, you know, taking this space away from me. I knew it because I knew that they supported the project. Mm-hmm. So I called them up, the Chancellor of Extension and Nick, and they said, this is just crazy. No one's consulted us. We don't want this space. This is your space. This is going to go for students. And so it was just, you know, it was bizarre, but, you know, I couldn't believe it. I mean, that was probably, of all the events that happened, that was just extraordinary. I mean, I just mm-hmm. couldn't imagine, as I said, the kind of mind that would think that up. You know.
How do you think this project has affected the university's attitude towards its historical resources?
I like to think that it's helped I would like to think that now we would not think about a renovation without a historic structures report. I hope it's helped. I hope it's helped. And I hope the other part of this was, you know, one of my worst nightmares was I used to tell the architects, no, I don't want pink shag carpet and naga hide in this building. By that I mean I was very, very worried about the adaptive use in terms of wanting to teach people that you can do adaptive use and it can be beautiful, and that you can have that braid or that continuity, you know, between the old and the new. And so I think the remark I hear the most often, and you know, nobody has any idea what my connection is, but I'll be out in the hall or walking through and I'll see, you know, some prospective students going on a tour, and I'll hear one say to the other, so I'll hear one student say to another, something like, you know, gee, this is a great old building and they sure have fixed it up nice. And I think, again, you know, I don't know that people would tell me honestly to my face that they're not happy with it. Maybe they would, but as far as I can tell, generally there's a very high level of satisfaction with the historic preservation and adaptive use. I mean, that's my opinion. Of course, that's from people who are telling me what I want to hear, right? But, no, I think it has been done very, very well.
Excellent. Have you gotten good response from alumni?
Oh, very, very good. Yeah, very, very good. And actually, I do want to tell this one story because you were asking me earlier what motivated me.
Mm-hmm.
There's one particular story that motivated me. When we had no idea whether we were going to be able to pull this off, I was invited out to the Attic Angels Nursing Home to speak in their continuing education series, and they wanted me to talk about the Red Gym. And so I brought a whole bunch of slides, mostly from the glory days, because mm-hmm. I knew that the people there would be, you know, 60 and above, and many of them were UW-Madison graduates, and that they would have, you know, been familiar with the building. And so I brought slides of, some of the slides I brought included a prom on the second floor and a men's basketball game. Mm-hmm. And anyway, there was a woman at that time who said that she was 98 years old, and she had started at the university in something like 1914 and graduated in 1918.
Mm-hmm.
And when I showed those pictures of the prom particularly, because she had attended several proms here, and then she had gone to the basketball games regularly, when I showed those two pictures, two slides, she got this look on her face. She was just absolutely lit up, smiling, and she was obviously transported back into some of the happiest moments in her, you know, late adolescence, early 20s. And I remember, I have a photographic image. I could, you know, I would recognize her if mm-hmm. she walked through the door. I don't know whether she's still alive. But I said to myself at that moment, whatever happens to this project, it will have been worth it to bring joy to this woman's life, obviously very frail, very, you know, infirm at that point in time. It was just extraordinary. It was really extraordinary. It was like, you know, we made this, you know, connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she said something like, good luck, honey, with something like that.
If you could do the project again, what would you do differently?
Oh boy, well, I wouldn't have to face all the you know, the landmines, and there would be a process that wouldn't be so cumbersome and burdensome, going to all these committees and you know, making all these presentations and having so many people involved. It's just a ridiculous process, to get a state project done here. It just should not be for anybody, for any project. So I would completely revamp the capital budget process for state-owned properties. And secondly, I guess, you know, I would try to rally even more students than I did, and I, you know, certainly was able to enlist lots of students. I mentioned student government, but I would, I think maybe I'd have a big demonstration at the beginning from students who wanted the project to, you know, highlight the importance of, you know, out of class mm-hmm. learning and all the kinds of things that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. You said that in restoring this building, you educated a lot of people about historic preservation and adaptive use.
Mm-hmm.
How did people resonate with that?
I think people resonate very well when you point out that, you know, simple things. There aren't very many old buildings in Wisconsin. that, you know, this is one of the few surviving armories and gymnasiums mm-hmm. of its kind. When you begin to talk about the La Follette Progressive Party, Republican Progressive Party conventions, the proms, the fact that it was the hub of activity for not only student and university events, but for major events, statewide events. When you talk about that, I think people understand that, and that historic preservation is not an expensive undertaking, you know, either. You know, people are always stunned when I tell them this building cost $122,000 when it was built, and that, you know, we have to maintain this rate of history. But again, I made this point earlier on, you can't preserve anything for history, a Greek temple or whatever it would be, unless you can find a suitable adaptive use so that you can have a budget so that you can keep it, you know, operational. Mm-hmm. Very important.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I'm happy that you're doing this history now while my memory is still with me, and I very much appreciate, Emily, your taking this on as your mm-hmm. senior thesis, and I hope it doesn't turn out to be more than you bargained for. But
it will be. It's always more than you bargained for.
But yeah, somebody needs to write up this history. You know, well, as I say, all these people are still around, and you could talk to. And I would urge you to interview, you know, the other folks that I've mentioned or people that I haven't mentioned that you come across. So thanks a lot.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
At the end of the interview.